13-20-63, John Anthony Koshgaran versus the state of Texas. This is an appeal from the 186th District Court of Bexar County, Texas. And for those who are viewing us live, this is a transfer case from the Texas Supreme Court to the 13th Court of Appeals. We normally don't hear San Antonio cases, but this is one of our transfer cases.
May it please the court. My name is Dante Dominguez, and I stand here for John Anthony Koshgaran, a man who was convicted in a bench trial, who did not voluntarily waive his right to a jury trial, and convicted based on evidence illegally obtained that his counsel failed to move for the suppression of or object to the admissibility of. And these errors worked synergistically, especially in one respect that I will address for the court. Now, this appeal brings three points of error, the first two being ineffective assistance of counsel for failure to move for the suppression of evidence, and the third being that the court abuses discretion in failing to hold a hearing on Mr. Koshgaran's corrected motion for new trial. Now, in the context of a failure to move for the suppression of evidence, the appellant, we have the standard is for us to prove by a preponderance of evidence that the motion to suppress would have been granted and that the remaining evidence would have been insufficient to support Mr. Koshgaran's conviction. And I do believe that we meet that standard, justices. Now, there are two separate and distinct suppression issues in this case. Number one, that Officer Sanders in this case illegally detained Mr. Koshgaran. And number two, that Officer Sanders searched Koshgaran's person with neither a warrant nor probable cause nor consent. And I will briefly address that first issue now. Now, within this, there was a question of fact for the trier of fact, in this case, the judge, to determine. Now, there was conflicting testimony between Mr. Koshgaran and the arresting officer. The arresting officer testified to the effect that Koshgaran was free to leave, that this was a consensual, casual encounter. That's how it began. And then Mr. Koshgaran was free to leave. To set the scene, justices, it was late at night, and Mr. Koshgaran, who had been seen twice previously by the officer in a hotel parking lot, was at this time walking along the side of the road. The officer pulled up next to him and struck up a conversation. And then the remaining unfolded. Now, obviously the judge believed the testimony of the officer. However, they did testify differently from each other, and this does raise a disputed issue of material fact. So that even if a motion to suppress had been brought on this issue and lost by the defendant, he would have had another bite at the apple with a 3823 instruction for a jury. But as we know, he did not have a jury trial. He had a bench trial. The second issue for suppression was the search of Koshgaran's person. Now, through the discussion between the officer and Mr. Koshgaran, the officer did attain consent to search Mr. Koshgaran's backpack. It was late at night. Through their conversation, the officer determined that Koshgaran had a sizable distance to walk. Mr. Koshgaran's cell phone was dead at that time. The officer offered him his cell phone. Do you want to make a call on mine? See if you can get this ride. Then the officer offered him a ride. Mr. Koshgaran accepted the ride. Then the officer told him he would have to be patted down and searched before entering his vehicle. Mr. Koshgaran said, thanks, but no thanks. And the officer said, well, earlier you gave me permission to search your backpack. Is that still okay? Mr. Koshgaran says, yes, takes off the backpack, surrenders it to the officer. The backpack is on the ground. The officer retrieves his canine. The canine performs an open air sniff of the backpack. Here we go. Now, it is our argument that that open air sniff and the two alerts by the dog created probable cause to search the backpack. However, at this point in time, the officer accepts that as probable cause to search Koshgaran's person, and he does so. He ends up finding some contraband in the small pocket of his jeans. Now, no contraband was ever found in the backpack. So that takes away the argument of inevitable discovery. Now, had the officer performed a probable cause search of the backpack and found contraband, well, then Mr. Kashgarian could have been arrested and a search of his person could have been performed incident to that arrest. However, we know by the testimony of the officer that no contraband was ever found in the backpack. So had he searched the backpack due to the open air sniff by the dog and no contraband was found, that probable cause would have been exhausted at that point in time.
Mr. Dominguez, since we're here before this court on an ineffective assistance of counsel issue as to your first two, it's a two-part question. Was, were any of these issues raised during the bench trial to the court as to not allowing this? There's a different scenario that's let forward because we're going to assume in a bench trial that the judge can ascertain what is admissible and what not is admissible. And how does that lead us to an ineffective assistance of counsel?
The only objection that was made as to admissibility was based upon the predicate laid by the state in getting the evidence in. There was no objection made, there were zero pretrial motions filed. And so this issue on the admissibility, on the suppression, was never raised before the court. And okay. I do believe that both of those issues are meritorious in and of themselves, certainly on the issue of the search of Mr. Kashgarian's person.
And if they were meritorious, then that would lead us to how on an ineffective assistance of counsel?
Failure to make the claims, failure to move for the suppression, Your Honor. And that's why I brought up to begin with the standard stated in Wirt, which is that we would need to show by preponderance of evidence that the motion to suppress would have been granted and that the remaining evidence would have been insufficient to support the conviction. So that is how Strickland applies in this context. And that is from Wirt v. State, which is 383 Southwest 3rd, 747, the jump page being 753, and that's from the 14th Court of Appeals, citing Jackson v. State, the Texas Court of Criminal Appeals case. So that is our issue on the search of Mr. Kashgarian's person. And if I may briefly address one of the additional authorities offered by the state, Lalande v. State. And this is a case in which a gentleman was arrested at an airport and then his bag was searched incident to that arrest. And this is from the Court of Criminal Appeals. This is from Price v. State, which is a recent case in which they summarize Lalande. Under the rationale of Lalande, the officers were entitled to search the suitcases as a search of his person incident to arrest, if for no other reason than that they were unquestionably belonged to him and would inevitably accompany him into custody where a protective search would take place in any event. And that kind of signals my point in this case, that had Mr. Kashgarian been arrested properly, well, then his bag would have been searched pursuant to that arrest. But that's not what occurred here.
If there was no motion to suppress and he pled not guilty and he went to a bench trial, what was the strategy of the defense at that point? Did they put on any kind of defense or did they just let the state put on their witnesses and then rest?
He crossed the officer to the effect that, what were you doing? You were striking up this conversation. You had no legal justification to stop him, but no objection was made to the admissibility based on what would have been the foundation of that motion to suppress. And this is something that I bring up in the case as well. There were no pretrial motions filed. Also, and this is from the record from volume 2, page 10, the court was in another trial at that time. The court was in a jury trial at that time. So a motion to continue would have, in all probability, have to have been granted. So there was no reason to push this to trial at this time. And I, for one, cannot think of a strategic reason to ask for a bench trial. Now, that can move us to point number three, But I would at this point in time like to address the second portion of the second suppression issue that we were discussing just a moment ago. One of the additional authorities that I offered for this court is Wyoming v. Houghton, and that's from 526 United States Reporter 295. And in this, Justice Scalia describes how the case of United States v. DeRay held that probable cause to search a car did not justify a body search of the passenger. That's pretty analogous to our situation regarding the backpack versus Kashgarian's person. He also summarizes Ibarra v. Illinois for the proposition that a search warrant for a tavern and its bartender do not create probable cause to search the other persons in the bar. And then he quotes Terry v. Ohio. Even a limited search of the outer clothing constitutes a severe, though brief, intrusion upon cherished personal security, and it must surely be an annoying, frightening, and perhaps humiliating experience.
Hey, let me ask you another question, Mr. Dominguez. As far as procedural history goes, possibly in the future, if this court was to find that there was ineffective assistance because there was a motion to suppress that was not brought up and he would likely have won on the motion to suppress, does that mean it goes back to the trial court so that you can raise a motion to suppress in the same trial court?
I think logistically that is what would have to happen, as opposed to a improvidently denied motion to suppress where you would instruct the court to suppress
certain. Go through it again, and then of course you have that appellate issue again if you go to either a bench trial or another jury trial. That's kind of what the procedural history would be, correct?
That is correct, sir.
Okay.
And with my last 2.5 minutes, I would like to address point of error number 3. Mr. Kashgarian's motion for new trial, 2 were filed, and both of those were insufficient on their face. A defendant's corrected motion for new trial was filed, supported by affidavit, supported by sworn declaration by Mr. Kashgarian, and brought up the point that he had not been properly counseled to the effect that he had the ultimate authority to make the decision on bench versus jury trial. And he, now, the declaration from Mr. Kashgarian does hold that the defense counsel did have some strategic decision in asking for a bench trial, and that was that Mr. Kashgarian was from New York and a Texas jury would find him guilty. Well, I understand the defense counsel had a strategy, but the decision was Mr. Kashgarian's to make, and he did not want a bench trial. He ended up having one. The court took him through the colloquy, as courts do every day in this state, and Mr. Kashgarian answered the questions that he was asking for a bench trial. However, the next day, Mr. Kashgarian brings it up with the court, and the court addresses the issue, but says that jeopardy has already attached, and this trial has begun. This is too late to back out now. And this issue is not determinable from the record. What Mr. Kashgarian was counseled as to his right to make that decision, and it being solely his right to make that decision, we cannot determine that from the record. So that is a matter that is undeterminable from the record, upon which Mr. Kashgarian could be provided relief. So it is our position that the trial court abused his discretion in failing to hold a hearing on that. And that, if I may quote Reyes v. State, it's 849 Southwest 2nd, 812, when an accused presents a motion for new trial raising matters that are not determinable from the record, upon which the accused could be entitled to relief, the trial judge abuses his discretion in failing to hold a hearing. And I see that I have 16 seconds left, so I might yield that time back to the court.
Do I have any other questions from Justice Longoria or Justice Tejerina? All right, we'll give you some latitude if you need some more seconds in the rebuttal, Mr. Dominguez.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Cho, your 20 minutes are on the clock. You may begin at whatever time.
Thank you, Your Honor. My name is Paul Cho. Good morning. I'm with the Bexar County District Attorney's Office. I represent the appellee, the state in this case. So we have here today basically two ineffective assistance of counsel claims followed by a motion for new trial issue. I'd like to take the ineffective assistance of counsel claims first. The first one with regards to the illegal detention as well as the illegal search allegedly of his person, followed by the motion for new trial. With regards to the illegal detention, I don't think there was any doubt that what it started with a consensual encounter. The video shows it. The judge clearly believed it. A consensual encounter. It's at 2 a.m. The officer has seen the defendant.
So you just said that the judge believed it. If there is no hearing on a motion to suppress, how do we ascertain what the trial judge believed or didn't believe? Because by the time he's hearing it, there's no objection, and it's the issue as to whether this was a valid stop and search under the force isn't even before the court.
Well, Your Honor, I'd like to think, as you were mentioning earlier, that a judge would, in his experience, be able to differentiate between what's admissible and inadmissible, and also as well as make implicit findings of fact based on what he's presented with
in arriving at his verdict. Any indication in the record that this judge felt that way, that any kind of findings that he felt that the stop was legal to begin with?
Not directly, Your Honor.
Okay.
Not directly.
All right.
So with regards to the illegal detention, alleged illegal detention, we have the officer, he sees the defendant coming upon, well, let me back up. Let's take the issue that we're here for, the main issue, which is the ineffective assistance of counsel. This is basic, under the Strickland standard, counsel performance must be deficient, and appellant must also show that counsel's deficiency prejudiced his defense. So under the first prong, he must show that it wasn't just, it can't just be errorless. It has, there's a strong presumption that trial counsel offered competent performance. So the deficiency must be found in the record. And if the record is silent, that presumption overcomes, is sufficient to overcome and to deny relief to appellant. Here, the record is very silent. It doesn't offer enough as to why they chose not to file a motion to suppress. There is just no, we only have appellant's side of the story in the sense that he says that he was, you know, he wanted it to happen, but counsel's strategy said, you know, for whatever reason, not to. But we don't have trial counsel's side of the story. And ultimately, in order to reach a conclusion, that's what we would need, his side of the story. On the second
prong, we decide that as a matter of law, the lack of filing a motion to suppress on these facts is per se ineffective. I mean, you have a case where obviously from looking on the record, there's some question as to whether the stop is valid or not, and an attorney failure to file or to object is ineffective on its face. Can we make that determination?
I'm sorry, could you repeat the question? I didn't quite.
In other words, without trying to get to whether it's, because we need to look at trial strategy or is the argument you were making, but can we ascertain that based on the facts of this case, that there is seems to be a question as to whether the search was valid or invalid. Can we say that the lawyers not filing a motion or not objecting is ineffective as a matter of law based on the facts before us alone?
Based on the facts before us. I think in this case, yes, we can, at least in the sense that we can find that the search was legal and as a matter of law. And I'm basing that on what the officers testified to in terms of what he knew at the time of the search. And
here's my problem with this case is that we're being asked, and it goes kind of in line with Justice Hedina asked, is that we're being asked to make a determination almost before the trial court is as to whether this search was legal or not legal, as opposed to us reviewing a trial court's ultimate decision, which is why it goes in line with Justice Tejerina as what would happen to this case. You know, we usually don't make, and by we mean the appellate court, isn't to make a determination without giving the opportunity to the trial court to make that determination. And it almost seems like we're being asked to make a determination as to whether the search was legal or not at this juncture.
Well, I mean, we are being asked to show whether there's a substantial likelihood from the prejudice prong to see if, you know, if a suppression motion had gone through, if it would had a substantial likelihood of succeeding.
That's a lot of ifs, Mr. Cho. I don't like that many ifs. So then my case is then are we not supposed to give that side in, you know, that we can't decide, or you're both presenting very good arguments this morning, a determination that someone could have decided this the other way?
It's something to consider. However, at the end of the day, the Strickland standard tries to avoid what ifs by going to the strong presumption that competent performance was given. And so it's on appellant. It's appellant's burden to bear to show that that was actually not the case. That, you know, if this had been done, then, you know, his side would have had a very, very strong possibility of winning, and it would have changed the outcome. So in this scenario, basically the law is in our favor, in the state's favor, in the sense that if a suppression motion had been given or heard rather, the facts are in our favor. It was 2 a.m, it was a dark portion of the highway. The appellant was offering very wishy-washy answers and sometimes inconsistent with what he had just said. It was in an area known for drugs, burglaries, and prostitution. Some of the answers that appellant is offering is inconsistent with what the officer had just observed him doing 30 minutes prior. And when he gives consent to search his bag, and when he when they do a drug air sniff by the drug dog, who is only trained, by the way, to search items, not people, because of his training as a protector of the handler. The dog alerts twice, signifying that the bag has residual odors for, I think it was one of the four different categories of contraband. When they search, so that justifies probable cause to search the person, because the bag was almost contemporaneously attached to that person. It was very closely associated with them.
As the testimony shows, the backpack was on the ground, correct?
That he had just taken it off and put it on the ground when the dog came back and sniffed it.
And you contend that's enough to have probable cause to search the person?
Yes, because of, you know, residual odors, they can indicate transference, you know, from person to bag, bag to person. I mean, if they were more removed in time from each other, then I would agree that the bag and the person, you know, are not as closely associated or immediately associated with each other to the point where, you know, hey, there might be a break in the link there. But here, they're very linked together because he had just seen him wearing the bag, he had just taken it off, and the drug dog sniffs it almost right away, right after that. And additionally, inside the bag, they do locate contraband. They find multiple IDs belonging to different people, that one of them he barely knows, another person he doesn't know, and a third person, they even find a check, I believe, that they questioned him about. And so that would have led to an arrest on its own, which means that he would have been searched anyway incident to that arrest. So, but they already had probable cause, backing up to the first point, they already had probable cause to search his person based on the drug sniff dog alerting twice to the backpack that he had just been carrying, and the dog being, the handler being aware that the dog is certified to detect residual odors so that even if the bag itself doesn't have anything, it was in contact very recently with something that did have those substances in them.
Do you have any case law that has a fact scenario analogous to that transfer theory that you're telling us about?
No case law, Your Honor. It's just, I guess I'm basing this more on just reasonableness and common sense. I know that and this is a slightly different scenario because this is more of a search incident to arrest. In Price v. State, a recent Court of Criminal Appeals case, they were looking at a person who had just gotten off of a plane and picked up his luggage, which was carrying, I think it was somewhere around 50 plus pounds of marijuana. When they finally arrested him at the curb of the road, they moved the arrest because it was on the curb of the road. And so all these people, you have taxis going back and forth to a secure office within the airport, where they then, while he's handcuffed, continued to search him incident to that arrest. And they searched the bags incident to that arrest, even though he's handcuffed and sitting down a couple feet away. The Court of Criminal Appeals ruled that because the luggage was immediately associated with the defendant near contemporaneously with that arrest, they could search the bag as well. So I hope that provides you some guidance, at least on that issue. So with regards to the second prong of their ineffective assistance of counsel claim, we can't speculate here on what was going on in defense counsel's mind at the time. We really need to hear their side of it, and they can't show harm as a result. So moving on to the second ineffective assistance counsel claim, appellant is also failing to show that his decision to waive a jury trial was involuntary. The record actually shows that he was very, very thoroughly admonished about what a bench trial would entail, and that, you know, they made sure that his attorney had discussed it with him. They made sure that he understood the nature of it and what he's asking for. They tell him that, hey, once you start down this path, there's no going back. They talk about like, hey, there's going to be another jury trial going on during this time. And, you know, witnesses are scheduled days apart because of scheduling. And so, you know, there's no going back, and this is going to be very difficult. And they even tell him a jeopardy is attaching today. This is the trial actually starts today. So once we start this, you can't stop it. And he acknowledges that he understands, and he still elects to do so. So that's what the record shows. So his claim that he was coerced just doesn't provide a reasonable ground as is required to show that, hey, I was, you know, that wasn't my choice. That was defense counsel's choice. And again, we don't know what was going on in defense. We don't know what defense counsel's side of it was. We don't know if what they talked about other than what appellant is telling us. So from that perspective as well, the record is silent. So it's just a silent record. There's just not much we know. In terms of the motion for new trial, he was obliged to abide by Texas Rule of Appellate Procedure 21.4 in order to be entitled to a hearing if he provided sufficient affidavits, if he provided reasonable grounds, and could make those showings. Here, Rule 21.4 is not at issue. So he's not arguing, appellant's not arguing that Rule 21.4 is somehow invalid. He's merely arguing that he was entitled to a hearing. But generally speaking, just because you want a motion for new trial, that doesn't mean you're entitled to a new hearing. As the Court of Criminal Appeals has said, that would allow for, you know, allowing everybody to have a hearing would entitle them to fishing expeditions. And here we only want to do it, you know, if they've done genuinely need or warrant a new trial. So under Rule 21.4, the way he would have provided, the way he would have pursued his remedy would be to have filed it within 30 days with an affidavit, you know, assuming that there wasn't enough information in the record or the record wasn't developed enough. You know, with affidavits showing how he was harmed. Here, and then in order to amend that further down the line, he had to have done it within the 30 days of sentencing and under Rule 21.4B before the court overruled any preceding motion for new trial. And if after that, then he would have had to filed it with leave of court. Here, he didn't file it with leave of court. The first motion for new trial was filed November 7, 2014, which was before sentencing. And it only listed bare assertions that he was coerced into choosing a jury, a bench trial over a jury trial. It was denied that day. On December 2nd, which was after the November 18th sentencing, he files a second motion for new trial. Again, it is denied that same day. And again, it's just bare assertions. Finally, on December 17, he files what's called a corrected motion for new trial, which is essentially the same thing as an amendment to his initial motion for new trial. It asserts the same things. However, this time he finally supplies affidavits to supplement, you know, his reasons for new trial. However, again, he did it without leave of court. So therefore, that motion, it was denied the next day. You know, the court in denying all those motions, it's no longer, because it's within the rules of 21.4, it's not arbitrary or unreasonable for them to do so. So therefore, you know, it's unfortunate for him that he couldn't get a new trial evidentiary hearing, but I'm sorry, hearing for new trial. But with that said, it was within the guidelines of 21.4. So therefore, he wasn't entitled to a hearing. I see that I have 2 minutes left. If there are there any questions that I can help answer?
I don't have any, Justice Longoria, Justice Tejeda. Okay. All right, then we will take back your 2 minutes, Mr. Cho. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Your Honor.
All right, Mr. Dominguez, your 6 minutes is on the clock. You may proceed at any time.
Thank you. And if I may begin by addressing the question put forth by Justice Benavidez concerning creating a per se rule. This is once again from Wirt v. State. And the court explains a trial counsel's failure to file a motion to suppress is not per se ineffective assistance of counsel. Counsel is not required to engage in the filing of futile motions. Rather, to satisfy the Strickland test and prevail on an ineffective assistance claim presented on counsel's failure to file a motion to suppress, an appellant must show by preponderance of evidence, and this is the standard that I quoted for the court earlier, that the motion to suppress would have been granted and the remaining evidence would not have been enough to support conviction. Also, if I may address the question put forth by Justice Tejerina earlier, and this is from Lyons v. McCotter, which is a Fifth Circuit case from 1985 that can be found at 770 Federal Second Reporter 529. To pass over the admission of prejudicial and clearly inadmissible evidence as here has no strategic value. And also a question put forth by Justice Longoria asking for authority to the effect that a positive search on a backpack, or I'm sorry, a positive dog alert on a backpack creates probable cause to search a person. I was unable to find anything directly on that line as well. Now, that is why I offered Wyoming v. Houghton for the proposition that probable cause to search a vehicle does not create probable cause to search someone's physical person. Also, I would point out that per my argument earlier and for counsel for the state's reference of the Price case, that's consistent with my argument that if Mr. Khashgarian had been legally taken into custody, the bag would have been able to be searched incident to that arrest. Or that if drugs had been found in the bag and Mr. Khashgarian was arrested, his person would have been searched incident to that arrest. But that's not the order that occurred here. Counsel for the state brought up the other IDs found on him. That's not what his conviction is for. That's not what this sentence is for, and that's not what this appeal is for. Also, in reference to the ineffective assistance of counsel claim, I heard counsel for the state mention multiple times that the record is silent on what defense counsel counseled the defendant over. And that does point to, and I'll jump on this point now, the need for a hearing on the motion for new trial. Well, if he did counsel him, let's hear from him on that issue. What my client heard, let's hear from him on that issue. But we have heard from him, and there is his sworn declaration in the record to the effect that he wanted a jury trial and expressed that to his counsel. He was told he would be given a trial by the judge because Mr. Sherman thought that a jury would find out that he is from New York and find him guilty. Well, that may have been a strategic decision on the part of the attorney, but as the United States Supreme Court has held, the accused has the ultimate authority to make certain fundamental decisions regarding the case as to whether to plead guilty, waive a jury, which is what occurred here, or testify in his or her own behalf or take an appeal. Also, although it was 2 a.m., although it was along the side of a dark highway in an area allegedly known for drugs, the Fourth Amendment still applies in that situation. And an officer still needs a warrant or probable cause to search someone's physical person. And that is not what occurred here. I also did want to thank the court. This is a transfer case from the Fourth Court of Appeals. And I do want to thank the court for allowing us to have this oral argument and for giving this case the necessary attention that it deserves. Are there any other questions from the court?
I have nothing further. Justice Longoria, Justice Hedina?
No.
This case will be under submission. We're